This program is sponsored by Cane Vineyard and Winery. For more information, go to cane5.com.
Good afternoon, everybody. It's Sunday, so that means it's the main course. I'm Patrick Martins. Really excited to be here in studio with Tama Matsuoka Wong and Eddie LaRue, who are going to talk about their new book, Foraged Flavors. Tama is a forager, and Eddie is the chef de cuisine at Danielle Restaurant. So it's going to be a very exciting show. Joe, you're in studio today. This is the first time we've ever worked together.
I know.
I mean, during a show.
Yeah.
We've worked at the butcher shop together.
Yeah, cut some steaks up.
Including your finger at one point.
And your finger.
And my finger. Oh, my God. I was like, I always thought I was a tough guy. I'm a good athlete and stuff. I coughed off a little part of my thumb, and I was like fainting, like lying on the butcher floor for an hour. It was very very shocking. Anyway, well, you're engineering and producing us today. We're going to start off the show by calling in to Heritage Radio Network President Jack Inslee, who's covering Bonnaroo for Heritage Radio Network. Jack, are you with us?
I'm with you. I'm also foraging flavor down here in Manchester, Tennessee.
Oh, my God. I saw Bonnaroo on Channel 26. They were showing footage from it. Is Jay-Z there this year?
No Jay-Z this year, but D'Angelo made his first U.S. appearance in 12 years last night. So on the music side, that was pretty exciting.
So tell us about some of the cool interviews you've retrieved.
Yeah, well, it was a 17-hour drive down here, and shout out to the 44 Communications team. They handle all the food PR for the festival. That's Chris Langley and Alexandra Hines. They've been really good to us and Jason Colucci and the Morning After team. So, you know, they also hosted Guga Muga, these Superfly guys that put on Bonnaroo. So they've really stepped the food game up for Bonnaroo also. There's a food truck oasis.
So tell us, what are some of the
food trucks around the country and a lot of local ones as well, to kind of come and serve more of the sustainable stuff and molecular gastronomy side of things. So, you know, I talked to a guy in Gastropod. It's a food truck from Miami. Turns out he listens to Cooking Issues every week, so that was really cool.
Cool.
And another one of the trucks was Gypsy Queen Cuisine from Asheville, North Carolina. And that woman actually made food trucks legal in Asheville. They were not legal up until she filed an ordinance and followed up. So in September, she won the case, and now food trucks are legal in Asheville. So we spoke to all the food trucks. We also spoke to a few of the performers. We chatted with Das Racist, rappers from Brooklyn. We've got Dispatch, Jean-Canabe, and the Boo Boo Gang. So tons of cool surprises on the way from Heritage Radio.
Well, that's interesting. And how can our listeners access your coverage of the event?
Well, I think we're going to put up a little clip right now that I'm calling into the show today. That should go online. And then as soon as we get back, we're going to edit all those pieces and put them right on the front page and on our SoundCloud. So stay tuned there with all the social media. We've got a lot of surprises. And a really cool story quickly about Roberta's. So as you know, Roberta's is there. And that's Brandon Hoy, Anthony Falco, and a bunch of the pizza guys. Lauren is also there. So the Bonnaroo guys promised them, you know, that they would get a lot of traffic, but the traffic wasn't showing up the way that they had expected. So they prepared to make 3,000 pieces a day. They're not quite getting that traffic from the general public. So what Bonnaroo did was set up Roberta's as the caterer for all of the famous people's parties. So
wow.
Chili Peppers, Radiohead, The Roots, anytime they had a backstage party, Roberta's was catering those pizzas. So they were making 50, 60 at a time, putting them on a golf cart, delivering them there. So very interesting the way the festival organizers made up for it and got them the traffic they needed.
Well, that's very interesting. Well, great report, Jack. I really enjoyed hearing that, and I can't wait to hear some of these post-produced pieces that you work on. But is it just me, or do you sound like you have not gotten any sleep at all?
No sleep.
Oh, man.
The bands, they keep playing until 7 in the morning, so even when you go back to your tent, it's pretty tough to fall asleep. But it's been a great experience and a lot of fun, and Brooklyn and Heritage Radio was definitely well represented. Even some of the people we went up to just to get email addresses said they knew us or they've been on a show. One of the girls was on Beer Sessions, so great to see the radio name spreading, and look forward to sharing these clips with you guys.
Well, I have 80-1 odds that you'll be back by Wednesday. I think you'll be back by Wednesday. 17 hours.
We're going to hit the road now. So
has your dad been helping you?
We're going to make good time.
Has your dad been helping you?
Yeah, he kind of wandered off on his own, surprisingly. He had a whole different festival experience. You know, he was moving at a little bit of a different speed, but he had a good time as well.
On the car ride back, he's going to confess to you that he slept with like 28 women. No, anyway, thanks for the call in, Jack. It was really, really exciting. And by chance, our guest, Tama, her daughter is at Bonnaroo. So what's your daughter's name?
Rebecca Wong.
Rebecca Wong. Look for Rebecca Wong. And
she can tell you how to forage over there.
Oh, perfect. I'll hold up the heritage flag and just start screaming her name.
I'm sure. Very good. All right, Jack. Thanks for the call in, and I'll see you next week.
All right. Good job, Joe. See you guys soon.
Wow, that was a very good report, Joe. Didn't you enjoy that?
Yeah, I've never been to Bonnaroo, and I kind of get what it's like now a little bit.
Yeah.
Especially with I didn't realize there was such a food thing there. I guess all I hear about is the music usually, but that's pretty cool.
Yeah, the food component is certainly important. That's awesome that Roberta's is catering the Red Hot Chili Peppers private party. That's great.
I'm gonna have to talk to Brandon when he gets back.
Yes, I'm sure Brandon will have some tall tales. Or some real tales that are also tall. Anyway, I am really psyched. We're just going to go straight into the show. We have Tama Matsuoka Wong and Eddie LaRue. Tama is a forager, and Eddie is the chef de cuisine at Danielle. And this Tuesday, they have a new book coming out on Amazon and all the local bookstores. You know, we believe supporting your local bookstore. It's called Foraged Flavor. There's a foreword by Danielle Ballou in it and photographs by Thomas Schauer. And it's about finding 71 plants, wild foods. It's their favorite 71 wild foods that they picked, I guess, together because they work together. So anyway, we'll learn about wild foods and how they work at Danielle Restaurant, but also how they can work for you in your own home, in your own backyard. So welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having us, Patrick.
So tell us about the beginning of this book, or how did you first meet?
We were actually working on a project. We weren't thinking about making a book. We started working on a project because I was eating at the restaurant. Some friends had invited us there, and I did not know Eddie. I'd kind of heard of Danielle Ballou, and it was only the second time I'd ever eaten in the restaurant. And these friends invited us to dinner there, and I had been very into plants. I'm kind of obsessed with plants, which you'll probably find out.
She's wearing green, everybody, by the way.
So I'm obsessed with plants, and so they knew I had this meadow and a lot of plants in it, and we've been playing around with some of the stuff, and they said, bring some in. It was in the dog days of summer and, you know, on a weekday, hopefully not the busiest time. So they said, bring some in and see what they say. It can't hurt. So I brought some in to the receptionist.
What did you bring?
I brought some anise hyssop from my meadow garden, which is a delightful herbal anise flavor. And so I brought it in to the receptionist, and I had a little booklet with me, which showed what my meadow looked like, so you could see the provenance and where it was coming from. And she said, oh, this looks really nice, and she called down to the kitchen, and I guess Eddie must have answered. They didn't really know, and she said, you know, do you know this? And he said, oh, yes, we know this, and we'll bring it just bring it down to the kitchen, and we'll see what we could do. And when we had dinner that evening, they had made, Eddie and Dominique had made two amazing dishes.
Wow.
In that couple of hours, and we were just amazed by the whole thing.
And Eddie, was that one of the first times that someone had brought you wild plants, or has that happened before?
No, we have a lot of supplier who comes and bring some product for us to experience. And that day, that it's true, the anise hyssop was so fragrant and with some hints of licorice that it was really interesting to play with it. And so it was one shrimp and watermelon salad we did with anise hyssop. And then we talked after Stama came in the kitchen, we introduced and she said, well, she can't bring more plants that I, after several years, I discovered exactly what characteristics of each one, but it was totally new for me.
So it's interesting, because I know you, Eddie, because we work together. You must have asked, what's the price?
No, it's not because
it's an interesting question. How does one charge for a bushel of wildness?
So in the beginning, I said, he saw my meadow. He said, what else do you have in my meadow? I said, I've got a lot of stuff in the meadow. I mean, I have 225 plants on my place.
What do you mean by meadow? You just mean...
I do like sort of restoring, you know, working with nature to restore back to a natural landscape.
So those are called like perennials, sunflowers, things like what naturally grows in a meadow in this region of the country?
Lavender bergamot, Monarda fistulosa, I'm going to talk. A lot of the stuff is in there. So a lot of things are in there. So at the time, you know, he said, "What else do you have?" Because he was so interested in that, and that piqued his interest. And I said, "What are you looking for?" And then this is sort of classic. Now we both remember. He said, "Bring me everything." He didn't want any specific thing, he didn't ask me the price, and I wasn't charging because this was just something I was passionate about. And so I'd say but it's kind of important. I don't think you just step into this and like, okay, now Restaurant Daniel's going to start paying you for whatever. It took a year of really understanding the discipline that I used, where I was doing it, and sort of researching hundreds of plants over the next year, every week for maybe an hour to 2 hours a week. And then after that, he decided which ones he wanted to put on the menu.
Wow. So you read from reading, you decided which wild foods most interested you for the menu.
No, it was from testing.
No, I would bring stuff in. Yeah, definitely. Okay. So it took from 2009 to probably 2011. We walk on the weekly basis. Tama used to bring some sample, and then we try, we talk. She teach me almost 80% of the plant, because maybe 20% of them I knew before. And then we start put in place a calendar according to the season where we can find for the next year planning the menu around it with some basic notes of each plant, what's the characteristic of the flavor. And since mid-year last year that you start to producing and bringing, and then we...
Wow, we've already come out with the book. That's impressive.
Well, it's 3 years of work.
No, but that's still a lot considering how many plants they are. You know, that's a lot of information to harness make into a 4-star restaurant menu. I mean, that's a lot of hard work.
So I think one of the things I just want to sort of impress upon your listeners is that it's not just identifying a plant that's edible, right? So this is the huge difference. So yes, there are a lot of things that talk about this plant is edible, this isn't. And that's, you know, you can find it at different websites and information. It's not that controversial about what's edible or not. The question is when it's good from a food point of view, right? So when is the season that's peak? So sometimes I would bring him something and he'd be like, you know, throw it out, right? And that would go on. And if it was something that, you know, I felt very strongly, but I would keep bringing it in, like the same thing, you know, every 2 weeks. And then after a certain time, he'd be like, oh, a light bulb would go off. And that was what was fun about it, that you would say, okay, now it's the peak time, and this is the part he wants.
So I have a nutrition question. Are wild foods more nutritious than domesticated, and are they more nutritious when they're at their peak? Is there a nutrition correlation to peakness?
Okay, I'm not a nutritionist, so obviously I can't answer that, but I do know there's been some studies seem to indicate that there's a huge nutritional value to wild plants because... of their variability. A lot of them have kind of a medicinal food background. Mm-hmm. And there have been some studies about antioxidant and immune system properties from them, which are incredible. Do you want me to give you an example?
Yes.
Okay, so one example, I think it was someone who at one point I would love to meet, who seems to be doing a lot of research on the nutritional properties of wild seeds. And there's some kind of index they use for antioxidant, for example. So your ordinary vegetables are something from like 5 to 250 on the scale that these scientists use. Blueberries are somewhere in the range of 3,000. We all know blueberries is one of the highest antioxidant. Sumac, American sumac, is something like 100 to 200,000 on that scale. I mean, it just blows away. All this other stuff.
And so where do you find it?
It's in your backyard.
It's in your backyard.
And it's actually on the sides of highways, but you probably shouldn't pick it on the side of highways. It's a common, beautiful, native shrub.
I actually find weeds beautiful. Yeah. I always never understood why people go to such lengths to cut them down. But very interesting. I was friends through my slow food days with Wes Jackson, who is the head of the Land Institute in Salina, Kansas. And touring the museum, I never really thought about it much because it wasn't my work. But he talks about how agriculture is basically hurts the land. It takes from the land. And so when you allow wild foods, which are very highly nutritious, grow right away, and like after a hurricane or a tornado, the wild field would grow right back. And the weeds, or I guess the trunks of these plants, go down 10, 20 feet into the ground, whereas agriculture goes 2 inches below. So very, very interesting. He basically says we're going to run out of usable land. It might be in a million years, but he's like the bellwether organization to communicate that message. Very, very interesting. So what is the difference between wild and domesticated plants?
Well, in terms of taste, it's they have more characteristic to the plant, even though they have more definitely more flavor. Like if you take the wild mint, for example, it's four times powerful. You have really a strong flavor of mint came to you even by the smell, and that's great about the wildness of edible plants. But it definitely have more character and more taste based of domesticated plant.
Very interesting. So yeah, there's just more packed into it without human intervention.
Well, what I sort of learned, and I didn't really think about this before, because of course we were doing this project because we were interested in it, not because we were trying to make something of it. But I sort of learned coming into it backwards is that I realized that herbs, even herbs, are probably grown or processed in order to make it useful from a commercial point of view for shelf life. Mm. So an herb will be, it will have a certain stiffness, so it'll go well into a package, and those are the ones that you're kind of growing and breeding commercially. Whereas a wild plant has this kind of softness of texture and somehow a variability and amazing flavor to it.
So all the best wild foods can be domesticated eventually. It's just they don't have, can they find their human like equivalents? I would say no.
I would say no. Really? There's a lot of plants that cannot just be domesticated. But the ones in our book, we've tried to use ones that are easily found. And the ones we have a different code about ones which are, you can pick all you want, don't worry about it. And we have ones which we advise you should not pick in the wild and you should plant, but they're originally wild. And those, yes, you could they have been domesticated.
Hmm. Well, tell us about, before we cut to break, and by the way, if anyone's in the neighborhood, Tamar's going to make a salad for all of Roberta's using stuff just growing in the cracks of the cement and here in the studio.
I thought Eddie's the chef.
Well, yeah, a little salad. If if it's something with cooking, then so tell us about. I'll ask each of you just name three or four interesting wild plants, just for our listeners to wrap their head around it. Maybe you talk, and then you tell where they'll find it.
Mm-hmm. So for me, the definitely one who was the most I was impressed was the pineapple weed. Mm. And as the name said, pineapple, and it truly smell pineapple out of and it's a very pretty, beautiful blood flower. And so for me, taste-wise, it's a cross between chamomile and pineapple flavor. It's amazing.
And how would you use it?
Well, I just did most of the recipe. It's very, very easy to replicate at home. Very basic ingredients, nothing to do to be scared. Daniel, it's not the... So you just do a simple broth, a syrup, and then you infuse the plant for 15, 20 minutes, and that's it.
How many bulbs do you need?
You don't need much.
Branches?
For, let's say, 1 cup of syrup, light syrup, you use probably 5-6 stems of... Mm. And it's very fragrant, and it's very clean taste. It's amazing.
This brings a whole new argument to, good food, sustainable food being elitist. That dish you just mentioned probably costs 25 cents to make if they can find these things.
Well, that's a wrong also. It doesn't take time to grow them because you pick up, but you need time to search them. And then you need to cut it and take care of it. They still have a lot of work.
Yes.
To preliminary before she bring to the restaurant.
But if you were a full-time hobo and you had nothing to do, you could with the George Foreman grill or a grill. It's very interesting to look at it that way.
Yeah.
And then tell us, where would we find it?
So pineapple weed is a native plant, but it grows all over the place. So you can actually, it likes very dry climates. And part of the beginning of this year, we're having amazing pineapple weed season because it was so dry in the spring, in at least the New York City area. So you could actually find it in, like, on the side of your driveway, in old farm fields. It likes sunny, open, dry, compacted soil.
Mm. Very interesting. All right, next.
Then the delili, the amazing thing about it, it's based on a 3-month period window. So at the beginning, it's like, it looks like a lix, baby lix, and it tastes exactly like a lix also, with a little bit more character, like French bean oriented. Then 1 or 2 months later, the buds comes out, and you use the buds at that stage, and you just stir fry, and it tastes like asparagus.
Wow, and you serve them alone like that?
Yeah, no, I serve it with some nori, a little bit of breadcrumbs, deglazed with soy sauce, and it was really an amazing flavor to play with. And then 1 month later, you have a fully grown flower, but it looks like a zucchini flower, actually. And you just remove the pistil inside and you stuff it with rice or any kind of stuffing. And it's the bite out of the delili flower, it's really like soft, buttery bite. It's no resistance. It's soft. It's really, it's same thing. It tastes like asparagus also.
Very interesting. Where do you find this?
Well, so the daylilies are what people plant all over their homes and in old farmsteads. You see the orange daylily all over. It escapes into the wild, and in some states it's actually become invasive. So it's very easy. It's not, you know, it's easy to recognize the flower. And just to mention, which is somewhat known maybe to your listeners, is that the bud of the, one of the reasons I first started bringing this in is because my in-laws are Chinese, and the bud, this is a great delicacy in China because China is a tropical or subtropical climate, not temperate. Mm-hmm. And the bud is what you find, the dried lily bud, in hot and sour soup or mushu if you've eaten those things. Mm-hmm. You know, so that dried thing that's not tofu or mushroom in there is the dried bud, which is a delicacy in China. So my father-in-law was so excited when he'd never seen it in his life, eating this all the time in China.
Wow.
He'd never seen this until he came here.
That's amazing. Well, very, very interesting. Well, we'll do one last one, and then I want to hear, we're going to come back and talk about poisons, and we're going to, you know, really get into wild foods and the relationship between the forager and the chef and how that works. Very, very interesting. We're also going to play a song, and if any listener can name what movie this song came from, they will get sent a free heritage turkey for Thanksgiving. So anyway, give us one last wild
Spruce
food.
Tips, definitely. That's the
which one?
Spruce tips.
Sorry.
So this is really like piney, gingery, and sappy taste, and I match it with some mango and tapioca, and I did a light dessert. Really, really interesting and flavorful.
I love tapioca, one of my comfort foods. I grew up going to Greek coffee shops on the Upper East Side, so rice pudding was homemade by the mother at the beginning of every day. So I love that kind of texture, yeah. Tapioca. And where can we find this?
Well, most people have... naturally, the spruce grows in a boreal northern climate, but the Norway spruce is one of the most planted screen evergreen trees, or for failed Christmas tree farms all over the country.
Very, very interesting. All right, we'll cut to break, and we'll be right back. Name this song. Get a free turkey.
Name this song, everybody.
simple thing has become.
All of us at Kane Vineyard and Winery are proud to support Heritage Radio Network and the growing movement to change the way we eat and think about our planet. For more information, go to kane5.com.
So we are back. I am Patrick Martins. We are produced and engineered by Joe Galarraga. We are sponsored by Kane Vineyards. We really want to thank Chris Howell and the team at Kane 5 in Napa Valley. Kane 5 is their signature wine, but they are absolutely delicious, and you'd be supporting a domestic wine when you buy Kane 5. And he's super dedicated to the plants, the soil, Napa Valley itself, so we thank them. And we have Tama Matsuoka Wong and Eddie LaRue. Tama is a forager for a couple of restaurants, but mainly Danielle. And Eddie is the chef de cuisine at Danielle. And they have a book called Foraged Flavor, which comes out on Tuesday in bookstores.
Hey.
And it's a beautiful hardcover book that has hundreds of or dozens of actual sketches of these wild foods.
Photos.
So I'm looking at them, and they all look like poison ivy to me, you know. So how do you know if they're edible? And tell us about the dark side of plants, okay, these poisonous ones.
Well, at first I'd sort of say that the plants that we have in the book, since it's a book for the public, are very carefully selected to be plants that are not easily mistaken for poisonous plants.
Mm-hmm.
So we're very careful about that. There are a lot of other plants that I do bring that are difficult to ID, and I would not recommend, you know, for a beginning forager.
Because they resemble poisonous
ones.
So
the carrot family. I would stay away from anything in the carrot family with an umbel-like, you know, umbrella-shaped flower. Because there is there aren't that many poisonous plants, but one of the most deadly is in the carrot family.
In the carrot family. I always thought it would have been the mushroom family.
Well, so, yeah, mushrooms also, definitely. So that's one of the plants, but for the mushrooms, yes. That's why we don't really feature a lot. We only have a couple mushrooms even mentioned in there, and those are ones that are not easily mistaken for a poisonous mushroom, because mushrooms, if you get it wrong, it can be poisonous, and you can die.
For instance, liver failure?
Yes, liver failure. I lived in Italy. From the Amanita family.
I lived in Italy for 2 years, and I realized they blame anything from a cold to, you know, a headache on their liver. It's always the liver. And it's so interesting. I wonder if they're big foragers or something, and they've suffered liver failure in their past, because they blame everything. Whereas in America, it always seems they blame, like, the heart. You know, it's always a problem with the heart, or maybe the brain, but... anyway, so how do you recommend? By the way, Joe, do we have anyone who guessed?
We had two people call in, both incorrect answers, but it does go along with our theme of poisonous plants here. It's from Into the Wild. So that was the correct answer.
Into the Wild, which is a Sean Penn, I think, produced movie, and in it, what does he actually eat and die from?
Yes. Well, I actually don't know the species, but our botanist who monitors our website, Carl Anderson, he mentioned that he died from a kind of a vetch. And a vetch is a plant that you see all over. It's been planted for erosion purposes, and the crown vetch is poisonous. And I'm not sure if that was the exact species, but that is one of the reasons why we're not talking about the edible vetch in the book, because we don't want people to make that mistake. But on the subject of plants and not being sure about your ID, we try to make the book as easy as possible for people beginning. Mm-hmm. But if they do have a question, they see something that's not in the book and they wonder, we do on our website have a forum, so you can post photos there and say, what is this? Is this what I think it is? If you're nervous.
So take our listeners through very beginning. So they decide, they read this book or they buy this book and they decide to go out there. What do they then do? I mean, where do they go?
Okay, so go I mean, anyone who has a backyard or a container or any place to grow herbs or a little urban 3x6 foot, any place you could grow a vegetable. And I think there's a lot that you can do in urban or suburban areas now. There's a lot of stuff on that. Any place you have a vegetable that you or herb, you may see weeds and things that are growing that you didn't plant.
We even saw some garlic chives.
Yeah, we saw it coming here. I was like, Roberta's,
really?
Yes.
Oh my
I think
God.
I saw some amaranths coming up there.
Very, very nice.
So yes, I would first, you know, you take the book. There's like very, very detailed photos in there. So you can look at them. And there's also descriptions of, you know, how to tell what they are. And the descriptions are field descriptions, which means you don't have to describe the entire plant. There are certain key things to notice in the field that are you're going to be able to tell, like one or two things, whether it is or not. We tried to make this very easy for people. But then if you're still not sure, after you see it, or you see something there that's not in the book, go ahead and post a photo. It's a service for the public.
For the public, for sure. Now, how does one gauge endangeredness in wild plants?
Oh, right. Okay. So, as a plant obsessionist coming from that point of view, it's not just really endangeredness, because today's declining plant becomes tomorrow's endangered plant. So there's a whole spectrum of plants and how they relate to the ecology of the landscape. Are they related to that or not? And I do recommend, there's this one book by Doug Ptolemy, Bringing Nature Home, which for a lot of people really brought that, which is that we have evolved the whole food, the whole cycle of food and the spectrum of plant to animal to human has evolved over thousands of years. And it's actually very specialized. So plants that have been in associated with the landscapes that we are with are very connected to that whole food chain, to pollinators, to et cetera. And plants that have come in from other places are not as connected. Mm-hmm. So those plants, which have come from Asia or Europe or et cetera, and have naturalized or are in the wild now, are very sustainable to take, because as you take them, you're not cutting into that food chain.
No, for sure. Very, very, very interesting. Well, Eddie, I mean, I wanted to ask you, how does the forager, but for that matter, you know, all your purveyors, I mean, how does that system work within Danielle? Because Tamam must not be the only person that knocks on your door and says, I have something for you to try. How do you navigate?
Well, as Danielle, we always have it's seasonal menu that we play around. So we do have a weekly menu also. So on the weekly basis, we have contact with all the suppliers and we see exactly what's going to come in the next week or next 2 weeks. And as Tama, we have a personal relationship because I need more information from her, so we almost talk every day. But she brings what it speaks of. Because it's true that wild plant, it's really, really short period, short windows that the plant will be peak of flavor, because then after it's too woody or too grassy or too... So it's definitely a weak window compared with other suppliers. It's more like month period of season, for example.
Very interesting. I've always been told the shorter the shelf life, the meaner the purveyor. So fish guys are the worst. Then meat guys. And of course, my wife, Anne Saxelby, where things get better with age, she's the nicest because nothing is ever going to spoil. But very, very interesting.
I do think from a chef point of view or a restaurant point of view, you know, it's not as easy to work with this kind of food as it is from just ordering a bunch of carrots. So, you know, you really have to have a passion and a commitment and a discipline to be able to work.
By the way, I'm never eating carrots again after what you said earlier. But but then how do you taste the food? So you say, hey, this is great. Or one of your chefs below you says, hey, I was at this dinner and there's this thing. What happens? How does it get? What's the process from idea to weaving it into a dish that you serve?
No, but so this has been done a year before. So before I decide to put the plant on the menu, for example, like now, tomorrow we'll have an abalone with some wood sorrel. I taste last year of the wood sorrel. I know exactly the taste of it. And it takes time to mature in your mind how you're going to create menu around that specific taste. And so... definitely, you need to have a database of a plant, and then you have the taste of each one. And when the season comes, we don't play the menu on the day to day. It's been tested. It's been so we basically we know we have an idea, a rough idea, a sketch idea. Are we going to play the menu for the summer?
And we have the calendar. We have the four.
Yeah, we have a calendar. So we definitely we have some tools in place that for me to remember each one.
Yeah, very interesting. You're like a statistician in baseball. You look at the batting averages of the opponents and everything. Now, are you challenged, Eddie, to break new ground all the time? Or are you challenged to stay true to classic dishes?
No, I challenge to stay true to the taste of the things we use at Daniel. So the challenge is to find the best taste ever to play with our dishes and to find, of course, the best art craft supplier that can bring the best best food in the restaurant.
So tell me about the Daniela is one restaurant, you know, Roberta's is very different, and yet they both taste good. So where is the line between right and wrong with taste? Because there are wrongs, right? I mean, it's not just
but each
if you
one,
like
each
it.
One is right in what he defined. The restaurant is the concept of a restaurant. Us, it's a refined French gastronomy, so we keep the root of classical French cuisine into the each dish anyway. And then the foraging part comes from, it's like a seasoning. It's minimum percentage of the dishes. It's not mm-hmm. like the main ingredients that is going to define the concept.
Dude, what cuisine do you most respect after the French tradition?
Well, I think Asian, Japanese in general.
Japanese, yeah. That's...
It's true to
be 70% of the chefs, the chefs I respect the most, answer Japanese. Very interesting.
Really?
I wonder, why is that?
Well, because as a chef, you always try to be as low-cover as possible. Mm-hmm. And Japanese, it's totally the concept. They don't import food from miles and miles. They just... use what it's 60 miles around the restaurant. So I mean, and that's why do a little bit of foraging at restaurant Daniel with Tama. It brings that concept that I totally embrace it.
And tell us, if I can ask, the connection between you and Daniel. I mean, how does that relationship work?
17th of June will be 10 years for me to be at Daniel, and so I mean, we know what Daniel wants, and that's why we have a long relationship. We have we design and we all have a team, good team at Daniel anyway, between me, Jean-François, and the pastry and the dining room. Everybody is totally behind the man.
I can tell, being an outsider really, mm-hmm. from is that there's really a culture. There's a culture in the restaurant, and he really encourages Eddie and others to kind of be creative and come up with things. It's not like a robot, like here's the thing and everyone just has to do it. They really encourage to do a lot, and because that's how Daniel is. He's so curious about everything, so he encourages that curiosity among the people that work for him.
So do you have looking back at the menus over 10 years, do you have any regrets and you're like, oh, I can't believe I served New Zealand lamb or
But it's of course, if you look back the menu over 10 years, we change a lot of style. Yeah, we definitely.
Isn't Daniel coming out with his book on that? Isn't his book going to talk about how things have changed?
We do. We're going to have a
in
book
in 2013.
2013.
Are you going to compete Forage Flavor with Daniel's new book?
It's very different.
No competition.
They promote each other.
That's good. So what's on the menu now for our listeners? So, they should go and I say 2-3 times a year if you can afford it. And if you can't afford it, you should go whenever you can. Once every 2 years, once a year, always to a place like Daniel. So what would they find on the menu?
So we're going to switch to our dishes. We have starting Monday, we have abalone with wood sorrel. That's going to be the season with zucchinis. Then we'll have wild mint that we're going to be with strybass and cucumber. We'll have also creeping jenny with flour, with cilantro. It's great with corn and potato gnocchetti. And we have a swordfish and anchoiso base around the sauce. We'll have also...
But you have like daily specials. Like.
Yeah, the daily on the weekly basis we do.
How many dishes come in the tasting menu?
On the percentage, you mean?
Like no, just how many dishes does one get usually? when they do the tasting
menu? We do a six course, or we do 8 courses, depending. Okay. Or we do a chef tasting menu also.
And the chef tasting is what, like
8 to 10?
Wow.
No, we don't do it's 8 to 10, yeah. Because for me, as a chef, or even my personal taste, I like to have several bites in my dish when I try something. So I'm not too fond of one bite and that's it, you don't have any more. So no, I'd like to have one bite, make my mind, and then take another one to make appreciate the taste behind it.
You're contributing to the obesity epidemic, Eddie. And I resent that. No. But I do really love it. You know, people always say, oh, well, a restaurant like Danielle is elitist. It's not for everybody. And I always maintain that that's classist. And my friend Nicole Taylor said almost semi-racist to presume that everybody should not aspire to have a great meal. So it is the most democratic of all things. It's quality is quality, whether you're poor or rich. If you can go once in your life or 50 times, it's a positive either way. Well, I have really, really enjoyed this, and I really recommend that everybody you know, get this book, Forward's Flavor. It's almost like a Bible of sorts because it has 88 recipes from Eddie. It has 71 plants, you know, found by Tama. And you can find these in your own. It's really the cheapest food in the world. Is just pick it up all, not off the highway because there's pollution, but you can find this stuff. Very, very interesting. You can learn more on the website meadowsandmore.com. Is that A-N-D?
A-N-D, yes.
Meadowsandmore.com. And thanks so much. Joe, great job. Are you still there, Joe? Are you, Joe?
I'm here.
All right, good. Thanks so much for everyone for listening. And Katie Kiefer is doing her Straight No Chaser in 20 minutes. So thanks for listening and stay tuned.
Thank you,
thanks.
See you
Patrick.
Next week. Thanks, guys,
bye-bye.
For coming in.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.